Thank you for tuning in to episode 199 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on PR.fm, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or whatever other program you'd like to listen to podcasts on. You can listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990. Just follow the instructions and remember that you will be responsible if there are any long-distance charges. I don't know that you're a listener until I hear from you, so send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, what you like about it, suggestions for future guests, what you don't like about it. If you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. If you'd like to sponsor this show, please contact me. You can make a one-time donation via PayPal using the email david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com or a monthly donation at patreon.com/infectiousmyth, and Patreon is P-A-T-R-E-O-N. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you're gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of, on just about any of the topics I've covered in my shows, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. When I started this show almost 200 episodes ago in 2014, I didn't expect to spend a lot of time covering vaccines. But what I've observed since then is an almost complete shutdown of any discussion of problems with vaccines, either a lack of effectiveness or safety problems, or both, in either the mainstream media or the scientific media. At about the time I started this radio show, up here in Canada, the mildly left-wing Toronto Star retracted an article on health problems that occurred after HPV vaccination because of pressure, not because of anything wrong with the article. And just a few weeks ago, the Toronto Sun, at the other end of the political spectrum, also retracted a mildly cautious article on vaccines after similar pressure. I was also determined to cover serious stories that other journalists don't want to cover. I don't know if they're scared or too uneducated about science to be able to see the gaping flaws in the mainstream stories. And what I found is that some very well-educated people, scientists, doctors, and others, are able to see the problems. They just aren't able to talk about it. Joan Shenton, who did a documentary on HPV vaccination and in the past has covered controversies in other medical areas, had her visa to Australia delayed so long that she could not be present for the tour of her film. The Australian government has a controversial visitors unit, and I'm not making this up. They wanted to investigate whether Joan had, quote, engaged or engages in speech that is likely to result in some form of harm in the community, such as views that could jeopardize public health. They eventually gave her the visa, too late for the tour of the film, but now she's free to go, which means that the Australian government has concluded that her activities do not jeopardize public health. I suppose that's progress. My guests have included Suzanne Humphreys, MD, world-class aluminum experts Chris Shaw and Chris Exley, pathologist Sinhan Lee, and forgive me for the others that I've forgotten. I hope you've been as impressed with them as I have. And now we have Mary Holland, a law professor, who will join the elite group of people who've been interviewed on The Infectious Myth about the HPV and other vaccines. Let's get right to it. Mary Holland, JD, has been director of the graduate lawyering program at the NYU School of Law since 2004. Before teaching, she clerked for a federal judge in the Southern District of New York, worked for an international human rights organization, and was an associate at two major U.S. law firms in international transactional law. She worked for American law firms in Moscow, Russia, for 3 years. She graduated from Columbia Law School, Columbia School of International Public Affairs, and Harvard College. Her research interest is in human rights and health law, with a particular focus on the law and policy of vaccination. She's also a co-author of the new book, The HPV Vaccine on Trial, Seeking Justice for a Generation Betrayed, which is the main reason for this interview. Welcome to the show, Mary.
Thank you so much for having me.
So one of the things we were talking about before the show is, well, actually a slightly different topic, but I feel that a lot of vaccine proponents believe that all vaccine skeptics are irrational, overly religious, fearful of science, etc. But there's actually quite a few vaccine skeptics who are educated in quite a variety of areas, such as science or medicine, and in your case, in the law. So what has your experience been with attitudes to your vaccine skepticism? Are people surprised to hear that a lawyer is skeptical of some aspects?
You know, I actually, David, think that the landscape is shifting on this. I think that I'm of a generation, you know, where we were, you know, brought up to think that all vaccines are good and that they're all safe and effective and that without them, you know, people would be dying in the streets. And I think as the vaccine schedule over the last 25 years has become so much more extreme, so different than what I experienced as a child and what, you know, most people around the world experience. I think there are many more people who are well-educated in science and medicine and other fields, including law, who are like, wait a minute, what's this all about? What's really driving this train? Is this really health or are there other factors at play? And one of the things I'm very proud of in this book, but in general, I work really closely with scientists and physicians. I mean, I don't, I'm not a physician, I'm not a scientist, but I'm working every day with scientists and physicians, and I'm asking them with my co-authors, you know, what do you think of this? Are we reading this article correctly? Do you agree with this point of view? I mean, we're very proud that we have the Nobel Prize winner for the discovery of the human immunodeficiency virus, HIV, gave us a preface for the book.
Yeah, I was going to mention that, Luc Montagnier.
Yeah, I mean, this is not untethered to science in the slightest.
Right.
But I also think it's an important point, David, that, you know, it cannot be just technocrats and scientists and physicians who get to talk about these issues. If this vaccine is being recommended to everybody, and it is being recommended to everybody, and certainly all children on the planet, then that has to be a discussion for everybody. And lawyers have to participate, and parents have to participate, and scientists, but not just scientists.
Right.
This is a law issue. This is a public policy issue. This isn't just a technocratic issue.
No, although I've got to say, your book really broke things down and was really looking at a lot of, maybe I shouldn't say so much the science, but the conduct of the clinical trials in particular was really quite, that was very clear and very detailed and in a language that I think almost everybody could understand.
Well, that's music to my ears.
Yes. So let's start with what we're going to talk about the HPV vaccine in particular, although I think a lot of what you say is applicable to other vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
Let me read what a few of the main health organizations are saying. CDC says HPV vaccine is very safe and it is effective at preventing HPV. Vaccines can have side effects. Many people who get the HPV vaccine have no side effects at all. Some people report having very mild side effects like a sore arm from the shot. The most common side effects are usually mild. World Health Organization, the WHO's Vaccine Safety Committee, considers HPV vaccines to be extremely safe. EMA, which I think is the European Medical Agency, the benefits of HPV vaccines continue to outweigh the known side effects. So we'll get into some more details of this, but, you know, just briefly, what are some of the things they're saying that you would not accept as true?
Well, I think, David, you're quoting from sort of the beginning of an introductory chapter where
right.
we want to contrast. This is what we get it. The global health authorities are telling you full speed ahead, everything's fine. And the whole purpose of the book is to say, that's not the whole story. If you have to make, you have a right to make an informed choice. And if you're only getting half the story, you're not, you know, you're not going to make a fully informed choice. So I take issue with all of those statements. You know, what we follow that those statements with are credible reports of injury, including fatal injury.
Yeah, you actually talk about Christina Tarcell, and I actually interviewed her mother. Mm-hmm. And if I believe it's the same woman
yes,
who
was
young woman who Yes, because she won a settlement from the government in this case.
Well, she actually won the case. Her case, unlike all of the HPV deaths and injuries, not all of the injuries, but like all of the deaths that went to the U.S. court for vaccines before Chris Darcel, all of them were settled. Her case, Chris's case, was not settled. She won.
Okay.
After 8 years of litigation, the mom won. I mean, it's a Pyrrhic victory. Her daughter's dead. But she won, and the U.S. government chose not to appeal that decision. That should really make people concerned. The government thought that they would not win on appeal, or they would have appealed the decision.
Right. Which is, they've kind of moved from the original kind of no-fault approach, like, we'll look at this. If there's a plausible explanation for the vaccine, we'll compensate. They seem to be fighting harder against that.
Well, they fight very hard. I mean, it's gone very, very far from the original conception. But they fight very hard, and they fight especially hard on HPV. And it's especially hard for people to win on an injury from the HPV because it's new and because all the science is not in. But even so, through, you know, vigorous litigation, Emily Tarcel, Chris's mom, won the case that her daughter's heart attack was due to the vaccine. She had three doses. She died shortly after the third dose of the vaccine.
Right.
You know, a super healthy athlete, wonderful young woman, whose life was snuffed out.
And yes.
People need to, you know, so that's part of what the book is about, obviously, David, is to let people know, look, that's a court of law. That's like, you know, this is not made up. This is not a quote-unquote anecdote. This is not even citizen science. This is more likely than not a U.S. court of law appealed once, came back down, and then the U.S. government didn't appeal it again.
Right. Another case sort of illustrates the other side of the coin. People who are severely debilitated. Alexis Wolf was a 13-year-old when vaccinated, declined to a fourth-grade level of intellectual development, had daily seizures, and at the age of 25, which is where you, I guess, were talking to her parents, she was still severely disabled. And there's a fair number of examples of this. There's a documentary, Sacrificial Virgins, you've probably heard about.
Yes, Joan Senton, I saw that you interviewed her. Absolutely.
Yes. So she talked about different cases.
Yeah. I mean, sad to say, David, there are thousands of these cases around the world. This vaccine is now being used in over 125 countries, and these reports are consistent. They're very consistent reports around the world, and these reports have been coming in since 2006 when the first Gardasil and Cervarix hit the market. So, you know, and unfortunately, this information clearly is being suppressed. Governments have recommended them, and corporations are making a lot of money on them. And so this information is not getting out to people. And that's, again, part of the reason why we elected to write the book. But Alexis Wolf, whom you mentioned, I mean, hers is a tragic case. Essentially, you know, no one knows how to recover that young woman. She's in terrible, terrible condition. And we include photos with, of course, the family's permissions. But we want people to really get this is, like, for real.
Yes. And I think in cases like this, it's not just Alexis who's suffering, but the parents are suffering as much
as
she is.
I mean, the mother had to stop everything. The younger daughter talks about, the younger sister talks about how she had to watch. It's as if someone had kidnapped her sister in front of her.
Yes.
It's horrible. It's horrible. This devastates families. It devastates communities. And, of course, you know, ultimately, it's going to devastate, you know, state coffers. I mean, this cost, caring for people like Alexis, is very expensive. It requires 24/7 care. It requires a lot of medicalization. I mean, this is... You know, this is insane policy. If in fact this vaccine does cause this harm on a regular basis to a substantial number of people who get this vaccine, then, you know, this is irrational.
Yeah, I think if I could play devil's advocate, wanted to defend the vaccine, I would say, well, okay, there's some cases like this. There's been millions of doses of the vaccine, and severe adverse reactions occur, but the benefits outweigh these very rare tragedies. So
well,
how would you deal with that?
That's the rhetoric, that the benefits outweigh the risk. And I think there's acknowledged that there's some risk, but as you read in the initial statements, the risks are downplayed, substantially downplayed. But even, David, if you weigh the risks against the benefits, so one of the really important things for people to understand about this vaccine is it's being sold as an anti-cancer vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
It has never been proven ever to prevent a single case of any cancer. It was sort of created to prevent cervical cancer. What it does is there's some evidence that it prevents cervical lesions, which, if untreated, may, in a minority of cases, lead to cancer. It's never been tested for some of the other cancers it's now being sold for, throat cancer, penile cancer. There were never any clinical trials for that. So it's being grossly oversold, and I think what's really frightening is that the risks are being minimized. So many doctors, many parents have no idea that if a child develops a GI problem, dizziness, a heart palpitation, weakness, fatigue, after they've gotten this vaccine, you know, they will not correlate it to the vaccine. Why would they think that that's related? But in fact, one of the doctors who was involved in the clinical trials, he headed the clinical trials for Gardasil in Denmark, Dr. Jesper Mielsen, and he then headed a clinic in Denmark for girls who were injured by the Gardasil vaccine and cervix. He estimates that the rate of injury, of severe injury, is 1 in 500. Teenage girls are at zero risk for cervical cancer, zero risk for other types of epithelial cancers at age 11 when they get the vaccine. They may be at risk of cervical cancer 20 to 30 years out, and there are many known cofactors.
Right.
And if they go for cervical screening, then those lesions would be caught and they would be treated and there would be a number of different interventions. So when you talk about the risk-benefit ratio, which I agree one needs to look at, it's hard to see that the benefits outweigh the risk if 1 in 500 could be permanently injured or die when these children are at zero risk for the cancer that this is aiming to prevent.
Right. One of the ironies I saw in your book was that you had a preface by Luc Montagnier, who received the Nobel Prize for HIV in 2008. The prize was split with Harald Zurhausen in same year for discovering HPV.
You're right.
It
is an irony.
Yes. In the Nobel Prize citation, it says, discoveries whether these vaccines that, you know, were newly released in 2008 are effective in preventing not only against cervical lesions but also cervical cancer and death must await the collection of epidemiological data during the coming decades. In addition, the duration of the vaccine's protection is unclear. Do they provide lifelong immunity or will booster doses be needed? Since the vaccines aim to protect against the two virus strains that cause 70% of the cervical cancers, will other strains emerge as a major cause of the tumors? I think those are reasonable
those
questions.
All still very live questions today, I assure you.
Yes.
None of those questions have been fully answered.
Yes. So is cervical cancer a major cancer in terms of the death rate?
Yeah. So in the developed world, in Canada and in the United States, cervical cancer rates over the last 50 years dropped about 80% due to Dr. George Papanicolaou, who devised the Pap smear, the Pap test. Women who go for regular cervical screening are at virtually no risk of death from cervical cancer. If they develop a precancerous lesion, or even if they have early stage cancer, it's highly treatable. As one of the people who we talk a lot about in the book, Dr. Lee, says, he's been working on, you know, Pap tests and other tests for women's health for decades. He said, you know, if a woman dies of cervical cancer in the developed world, that is a malpractice case, 100%, because that is absolutely treatable. The women in Canada and the U.S. who have late-stage cervical cancer or who sadly, tragically die of cervical cancer, that's because they weren't getting regular screening, because it can be checked. In the developing world, in the low-resource world, in India, in Africa in particular, in China, These are countries where cervical cancer is very serious, right? So there's not regular screening in those countries. And in many of those areas, women start having babies at a very young age. Smoking is a cofactor. Cooking over open fires with a lot of inhalation of toxic fumes is a cofactor. Mm-hmm. So in the developing world, cervical cancer is absolutely a killer and a very serious health challenge. In the book, we, in part three, which is our sort of deep dive in the science, we talk about some of the remarkable things that are being done in the developing world to prevent and to treat cervical cancer. There's a lot of low-cost technologies that have now been devised to make sure that women are not, they don't have to die from cervical cancer in the developing world. The fallacy, though, David, the idea that this vaccine may save women in the developing world, well, cervix covers two types of HPV that we know cause cervical cancer. Gardasil covered two as well. Gardasil 9 covers more, but it doesn't cover. There's over 200 human papillomaviruses, right, and many of them are associated with cancer. And one of the other important points in our deep dive in the science is ethnic groups have different tolerances of these viruses. So African American women, for instance, are not at risk from the same human papillomaviruses that Caucasian women are at risk from, typically. Their cancers are not the same viruses. So coming up with this one-size-fits-all prevention for cervical cancer, it's just, it doesn't work. It's not going to work around the world.
And also, it seems to me, it's known that in many cases people become negative to a strain, and one might ask, what are the things that can help with that? Is it diet? Is it some environmental issues? So that would seem like a low-tech way.
There's lots of low-tech ways. So diet, absolutely. Cervical dysplasia, sort of if cells are not growing properly, absolutely diet can be one way to address that. In low-resource countries, they literally use a technique to use vinegar and to kind of kill off those cells that are, growing abnormally. That's another low-resource technique that's being used. Cell phones are being used, with cameras and sending digital images to physicians who are remote from them, and figuring out what the staging is and what needs to be done. Maybe at a later stage, a woman might have to go to some other place. But the fallacy that you can just give this vaccine and then cervical cancer is going to disappear with no continuing sexual health, availability, no cervical screening, no other kinds of intervention for reproductive health, that's just not accurate. It's just wrong. You can't just give the vaccine and say, "Oh, well, we're done." That's all we have to do.
And it's not a cheap vaccine.
The most expensive vaccine that's ever been marketed, and that's really important, right? So it's been sold in the developed world. It's been sold, aggressively in Canada, in the United States, in Western Europe, and in essence, and where cervical cancer is a very low threat, as we've just discussed. Mm-hmm. And in essence, that's sort of building up the financial pool so that then it can be launched in the developing world and, at a lower price so that there's greater access to this vaccine. And, it's now hundreds of millions of doses have been distributed. It's in over 125 countries. And the sad part is that, we don't know whether it's really going to prevent cervical cancer. There's some evidence, there is evidence that it does reduce the incidence in, 10 years of cervical lesions from these particular types. There's evidence of that. But there's also evidence, which is very troubling, that young women have gotten the message, partly from advertising, because these vaccines have been heavily advertised, at least in the United States, where that's legal, young women have gotten the notion that they don't need to go for cervical screening.
Right.
And as a result of that, there's a Scandinavian study that suggests that these young women are at higher risk of cervical cancer because they no longer go for screening.
To switch topics, I wanted to talk about the conduct of the clinical trial because I think that most people people think, okay, you can argue these theoretical issues, but you know, this was tested with the,
right.
the best science in the
right.
world. And this took me the last couple of years to kind of figure out the problems with the placebo in the vaccine, in vaccines in general, and in particular in this case, there's a number of issues with it. You call it a faux-cebo
right.
instead of a true placebo. So I would think, okay, a placebo for a vaccine would be like saline or something with, you know, no possible impact on the body. So what was used in these trials?
Right. So exactly right. We focused the whole first part of the book on the clinical trials because this is the bedrock for the vaccine. You know,
mm-hmm.
if these weren't right, then the whole game is off. Right?
Right.
And what we found is that it is just riddled. The clinical trials, both for Merck and GlaxoSmithKline's HPV vaccines, were riddled with problems.
Mm-hmm.
So let's start with the first fundamental issue that people who put themselves at the risk of a clinical trial before a drug or a vaccine has been approved by a federal health regulator.
Right.
Those people are putting themselves at risk as volunteers. They are really doing something that, you know, is in the public's interest, and they need to give prior, free, and informed consent. That's the
right.
global standard. And so we got to know two young women in Denmark, Cecilia and Cecilia, and they were in the clinical trials. And remarkably, they learned after the fact, because they don't know what they get, one of them got the vaccine. This is the Merck trials. One of
right.
them got the vaccine. One of them got the so-called placebo. Both these young women gave us documents that we photograph and put in the book. Both these women were given documents that told them that the placebo was saline and that the vaccine had already been safety tested and that it was known
okay.
to be very
that's,
safe.
That's two very important things.
Very
would...
fundamental. And these were young women. These were women,
right.
you know, below age 20. And they and their families relied on that information to make the decision for these young women to participate in the clinical.
Right. I mean, those are blatant
lies.
They
were lies. Those were blatant black and white lies in print that we include in the book.
And to just repeat them, so the first lie was that the placebo was saline, and it wasn't. And the second was that it had been safety tested before, but it hadn't. So what was in the placebo that could have
right.
caused
Cecilia's
symptoms?
So remarkably, they did test Gardasil. Merck did test Gardasil on close to 20,000 individuals. That's a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
But none of those people, not one in the control arm of the clinical trial, not one received a true placebo. In other words, an inert substance that could cause no medically discernible effects.
Mm-hmm.
The vast majority of the people in the control arm received an aluminum-containing adjuvant. In other words, they received so-called what was the so-called placebo. They received something that is known to cause neurological toxic effects. It was also in the vaccine arm. So by putting this in the control arm, they masked the side effects that were happening in the vaccine arm.
Okay? They statistically made the side effects disappear, because if you have X side effects in the vaccine and X side effects in the placebo, you would say then, well, clearly the vaccine didn't cause those side effects because there's the same number as in the placebo.
Right. So you might, if you were sort of really interested in health, you might say, oh my gosh, there's X side effects in both groups. You know, there's dizziness, there's nausea, there's inflammation at the site, there's, you know, pain syndromes. You might say, well, this goes to problems in both arms. And we know that we gave the control arm aluminum, which we know is neurotoxic and toxic in general to the body. You know, we shouldn't be doing this. But that's not how they rationalized it. They said, as you point out, more or less, there were comparable problems in the vaccine arm and the control arm. So they said, okay, well, then it's safe.
Yes.
There was a small group, though, David, that didn't get the aluminum-containing adjuvant
mm-hmm.
in the control arm. And they advertised that that group just got saline. But even that group did not get saline. They didn't get, the very small group did not receive the aluminum adjuvant, but they still received what they called the carrier solution. And in addition to the aluminum-containing adjuvant and the virus-like particles, the sort of genetically modified virus-like particles to induce the immune response to the HPVs, they also had sodium borate, L-histidine, and polysorbate 80. Those are ingredients that we talk about in the book. All of those ingredients are really problematic. So sodium borate is not allowed in any foods in the United States. In Europe, it has a fertility warning on it. Polysorbate 80 is an emulsifier that's put in things, and it's known to permeate the blood-brain barrier. These are really significant chemicals that were in
yes.
the so-called real placebo.
Right. One of the tragedies this caused, which I found quite shocking, was that Cecilia had been suffering side effects. And then in 2007, when they unblinded the trial, she discovered that she had been receiving the placebo. So she believed what they had said, that it was just saline. So she said, well, obviously the vaccine has nothing to do with my health problems.
Right.
So then she took 3 vaccine shots.
Right.
So she ended up with 6 shots of aluminum. Which
That's exactly right.
Because the drug company lied to her and about the placebo.
That's right. And she is herself a scientist. And so both Casilla and Cecily are now deeply involved in trying to undo this and to try to bring this to light and to speak out about this. And she's not going to be alone, David. So the people who have received Gardasil over the last 12 years, many doctors are recommending that those people now get Gardasil 9 because there's additional types. And so Gardasil 9 has an even higher level of this aluminum-containing adjuvant, and the aluminum is very problematic. So we include in the book discussions of science articles that Dr. Sinhong Lee has published. And Dr. Lee, I mentioned him before, he's been involved in women's health for 50 years.
I've actually interviewed him before.
as well as
Chris Shaw and Chris Exley. So
oh, my goodness.
I'm in good
company, and you have many of the people who've influenced the book.
Yes.
That's great. Dr. Lee, anyway, really proved that this aluminum-containing adjuvant is forming these novel chemical compounds together with these virus-like particles, and that some people are unable to decompose them and to pass them out of the body. And in a girl that he performed autopsy analysis on, he found these novel chemical bodies of the VLPs and the aluminum-containing adjuvant. He found those in her body on autopsy. And he proved to Merck that this was definitely their proprietary VLP by sequencing it. So there's problems with the aluminum-containing adjuvant, and it was absolutely bad science to put those in both arms of the trial. And the fact that the FDA approved it, to me, is one of the true tragedies of this, that our regulators really, for reasons that I find fairly inexplicable, just aren't really doing their job.
Yes, I mean, in this case, everybody was faced with the reality that if you insisted that the vaccine be tested against a reduction of cancer, it would take so many years to perform the trial that you would never get a vaccine, which I'm not saying necessarily would be a bad thing given the problems with the vaccine, but that gave the drug company and the FDA an excuse to turn around and say, well, we'll test a surrogate marker. And what were the games that Merck, or I think it was Merck, played with the surrogate marker, with the sort of CIN thing?
You're right, that because it would take so many people and it would take so long to use cancer as the endpoint, the FDA allowed Merck in its clinical trials for Gardasil to use cervical lesions as a so-called surrogate endpoint. So they were able to use cervical lesions at stage 2 and stage 3 as a proxy. And we look in depth at that question, whether or not that's legitimate. We think that it's questionable because, in fact, most SIN2 and SIN3 lesions actually regress on their own. So sort of saying that, oh, well, if they develop SYN2 or SYN3, it's going to necessarily go to cancer is a false paradigm. But and the reason, what also the sort of fast-tracking which Merck received enabled them to provide information in a sort of a running manner and not wait until everything had been amassed. They were able to do it on a sort of a rolling basis. But that still doesn't explain, David, why the FDA permitted Merck to use an aluminum-containing adjuvant and a carrier solution as their placebo. Those are distinct questions. And they certainly could have used a surrogate endpoint and still have used a true placebo. I think, sadly, the likelihood is the reason that they didn't use a true placebo is had they used a true placebo, the level of side effects would have been crystal clear, and likely they would not have been able to gain approval for this vaccine. I mean, I think that's the conclusion that one has to infer, or is certainly a likely inference that one can make. Otherwise, they would have used saline, and they misrepresented what they did use as saline, signifying, I think, that saline is the proper control to use. And we point out that the World Health Organization that has endorsed this vaccine strongly, according to their guidance, a new vaccine, a brand new vaccine, should always be tested against a saline placebo. There's no question that the right thing to do.
When did they change their mind on that, or did
well, they didn't change their mind on that. It had to get approval from the FDA and the WHO.
No, I'm saying that the World Health Organization is saying you should use a saline
placebo. Yeah, they do, and they take a pass on Gardasil. And now, then, when we now in the United States, I don't know about Canada, Gardasil is no longer on the market in the United States. In the United States, the only HPV vaccine that's now available is Gardasil 9. Also, Glaxo removed its product Cervarix from the U.S. market because it was trailing way behind the sales for Gardasil. But Gardasil 9 was able to be tested against Gardasil, right? That's sort of okay by sort of health regulatory standards. But let me point out, as it sounds like many of your listeners probably know, that vaccines are considered very differently than drugs. So drugs do have to go through some pretty rigorous clinical trials, double-blind placebo-controlled trials. Not to say there's not some trickery that goes along there, but with vaccines, which are considered biologics, they don't have that absolute requirement for real placebo-controlled trials. They don't have it. And so they got away with it. Both products got away without using true placebos.
Yes, which is pretty shocking.
Shocking, and it's frankly, you know, these are being marketed in this country, but they're being pushed around the world on children. These are not, you know, drugs where they're really being pushed on adults and adults can make a sort of a well-informed choice. These are being pushed on parents or directly on children, saying, you know, this is for your own good. The government recommends it. Take it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very shocking that this was never properly tried. It was never properly tested.
Right. We're talking 11, 12, 13-year-olds, right?
Yeah. So the target market, so initially, most of the people in the clinical trials, this is another troubling dimension of the clinical trials, In most of the subjects in the clinical trials were between 15 and 26. They were an older age cohort.
Mm-hmm.
And after those clinical trials were well underway, there were a number of problems that were observed in that older age cohort. One was that when women had to be not pregnant to enter the trials, but some women did become pregnant. And we have a chapter in the book talking about what happened in the pregnancy registries for both Cervarix and Gardasil. And what we see are a lot of problems with fertility for those women who did become pregnant in the clinical trials.
What do you mean problems with fertility in women who became pregnant? I thought a problem with fertility was that you couldn't become pregnant.
Well, there's a variety of things, but some women did spontaneously become pregnant
mm-hmm.
while they were getting these vaccines.
Right.
And what was observed, and this is observable from the registries that the corporations did keep
right.
of those women who did become pregnant, is that there was a very high level of spontaneous abortion.
Oh, so I see what you mean, yes.
That there were miscarriage is the word I want to use. There was a very high level, double the sort of background rate for miscarriages.
Right.
And also there was a higher rate of congenital abnormalities in the infants that were
in
born to mothers.
Both the vaccine group and the control group, because of the placebo, right?
You know, I don't remember that offhand, to be honest with you. But I mean, it makes that was. I think what they really were concerned about was in the vaccine group, and in the vaccine group, the level of the problems with the pregnancies were discernible. And in the product inserts in several countries, each country has its own product insert depending on its regulator, there are warnings about pregnancy and the HPV vaccine.
I've seen several times mentions of ovarian failure as
right.
a side effect, which is permanent sterility in a woman. And, you know, that you're targeting women. Well, they're not women yet. They're girls, right? You're
right.
targeting girls who are not sexually mature, so they obviously haven't had children yet. So that's it for those women, right? They're never going to have a child.
Well, I think there's some... I don't know that we can say that definitively, but I don't know, honestly, to what extent this could potentially be reversible. But so I was talking before about the problems that they observed, but one of the things that we are now observing 12 years out from when this vaccine came on the market in a big way in many developed countries is that the teenage pregnancy rate has dropped dramatically.
Uh-huh.
In countries where there was high uptake in the U.S., in the U.K., in Australia, in countries that track teenage pregnancy rates, and obviously teenage pregnancy is generally not seen as a desirable thing,
right.
but there's been a dramatic decline. And it really, the decline starts in about 2008, which is when the vaccine was really starting to have a wide uptake.
I've never thought of a teenage pregnancy rate being a good thing, but I mean, if the
right.
reason teenagers aren't getting pregnant is because more of them are becoming sterile, that's
fertile,
not a good thing.
Exactly. So a 50% drop since 2007 in the U.S., completely unexplained by, you know, any other data. So we don't know if this is correct, but you know, we look here at one study by an economist, Gail DeLong, who, you know, works in statistics. I mean, she's looking at this, and you're right that the episodes of premature ovarian failure, we look at a Stanford study, and before, you know, the time of this vaccine, there were virtually no cases of premature ovarian failure. I mean, it was just exceedingly rare, and it's now become not so rare. And one physician in Australia, Dr. Deirdre Little, did a couple of case studies regarding women who were young women who were experiencing premature ovarian failure. And so the mechanism seems to be, you know, fairly. There seems to be a pretty significant link. And one American pediatric group, a sort of minority pediatric association, has put out a statement to its members to be concerned about premature ovarian failure in this vaccine.
I read that statement, and it seemed a bit strange because you have no way as a parent of knowing whether, if you encourage your daughter to get vaccinated, whether she's going to experience premature ovarian failure. And everybody's probably going to regret it immensely if she does. So, you know, what good does a statement do except to say, okay, I'm not going to get the vaccine because I'm not going to take the risk. But there's no way to identify women who are at risk of that.
There's no way to identify. But I think that, yes, I hope that, you know, that information that there is a risk of premature ovarian failure will make families, you know, stop and think twice about whether they want to take this medical intervention of questionable necessity, right? Because if the girl continues to get some kind of cervical screening and, you know, health care, she's not really at risk of cervical cancer.
Yes.
In that sense, David, this is a very different vaccine than the measles, say, or, you know, pertussis. This is not a typically infectious disease. They're sort of saying that it's primarily sexually transmitted. And there's a remedy, right? You go for screening. It's not
yeah.
like if you don't get this vaccine, you're going to get cancer, although that's sort of the marketing
right.
of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the case. If you go for if you lead a healthy lifestyle, you're not going to get cervical cancer, period. If, you know, you have a number of cofactors or genetic susceptibility, well, then if you go for regular screening, it's going to be precancerous dysplasia is going to be found or early stage, and it's treatable.
Yes. Yes, it just seems, if you think about this rationally, you wouldn't take it. But we're now living, I think since the measles so-called epidemic at Disney World a few years ago, we're living in a world where there's almost a complete prohibition on anything critical of vaccines. Just a couple of days ago, the Toronto Sun, which is a tabloid in Canada's biggest city, published a mildly anti-vaccine article, you know, or urging some caution with vaccines. They do have side effects and stuff like that. And within a couple of days, it was pulled off the website of the newspaper because of the pressure to not put anything negative about the vaccines. So how can you have informed consent when any critical voices are being silenced?
Well, we talk about the episode in the Toronto Star where there was real journalism about, you know, reported injuries from the HPV vaccine to Health Canada. And pressures were put to bear on the newspaper and they retracted it.
Yes.
And we discussed the censorship around this particular vaccine in a number of contexts. And the censorship is very real. There's censorship not only in sort of the public domain, but also in scientific literature. We talk about a particular study that was done by Dr. Schoenfeld and Dr. Shaw and others about autoimmunity in mice being induced and having symptoms from using the HPV vaccine. And that article was retracted from the journal Vaccine with no stated reason, even though
yes.
it had been accepted.
Yes.
So the censorship is very real. We're grateful to you for wanting to talk about this and do a podcast on it. It's very challenging for us to discuss this book in the mainstream, although we think it's very topical. I don't know if you know that in the U.S., the Centers for Disease Control has just now recommended Gardasil for all adults up to age 45. There's a lot of risk factors for all adults
up to
age 45 to get this vaccine. So our book is really relevant to coverage that mainstream media is giving this vaccine, and yet it's not covered because it is critical. And we think that's really sad commentary on sort of corporate influence and sort of black and white thinking. I mean, not all vaccines are the same, and not all, you know, benefits are the same.
And compensation in the United States is pushing $4 billion since the 1980s, that's with a government that really doesn't seem to want to compensate people. I understand about half of claims are denied, and a lot of people don't claim because they don't know about the rather obscure vaccine court, as it's called.
Right, right. It's even more. It's about two-thirds of people don't get compensated, and the statute of limitations is 3 years, as you mentioned. So most people have no idea that that's the only place they can go and that they have only 3 years to go there.
Right.
So we don't know how many people are injured by vaccines at all.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's a growing body of people who recognize that they have been injured by vaccines. But, you know, one of the things that's notable about this vaccine is that the rate of reported injury among the age group of people who get this vaccine, the reported rate of injury is much higher than for other childhood vaccines.
Right.
So this is a particularly, you know, the data suggests that this vaccine is particularly dangerous. What the data show since it's been on the market is pretty consistent with what was observed in the clinical trials. It just wasn't adequately kind of thought through, frankly. I mean, another issue we didn't touch on in the clinical trials is that they did find what they call the issue of negative efficacy. It turns out that if someone has already been exposed to a human papillomavirus and has cleared it or has an active infection, and they get the vaccine at the same time, that vaccine is actually going to put them at higher risk, 44% higher risk, if they have an active infection and cleared an infection in the past, when they get that vaccine, because it's going to cause an inflammatory process. And yet, there's no screening for people to see if they have an active HPV infection. There's no screening for people to find out if they're pregnant. It's not recommended by the main medical bodies. So, you know, we are actually putting some people at risk by giving them. We're knowingly putting some people at risk
by
giving them this vaccine.
Have they started going after boys now?
Well, in the U.S., the recommendation is for boys and girls, and this new federal recommendation is for men and women. So for men, the notion is that it is going to prevent anal cancer. There's a little bit of evidence for that from the clinical trials, not very much, but they're selling it as prevention for penile cancer and for throat cancer, because that those are also epithelial tissues, and the notion is that HPVs, you know, live there. But there's no clinical trial evidence of that. That's just being oversold.
And the statistics, which are not something you really cover too much, but the statistics are flat with diagnosis of cervical cancer amongst young women. They're not going down anymore.
No, and in some cases they seem to be going up.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that if one of the things that we've discovered, the science suggests that there are other ways to contract a human papillomavirus infection. It's not just sexually transmitted, and that some people get it, you know, however, they just get it. And so, you know, children who are getting this vaccine as 11 years old, they may still be actually being put at risk because they have an HPV infection.
You talked a little bit about the Cochrane Collaboration Review, which gave the HPV vaccine a clean bill of health, and then three other people involved with the Cochrane Review, Jorgensen, Gottschy, and Jefferson, criticized it, and then Gottschy got kicked out of the Cochrane Collaboration. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So we mentioned Denmark before. So Denmark is one of the countries, the last part of our book, we talk about sort of what's happened in a number of different countries around the world with this vaccine. And in Denmark, the vaccine has been particularly controversial. And about now, the uptake was very high, somewhere, you know, in the 90% zone, and it's now well below 50%. And you know, there's been a lot of controversy. A lot of young women were injured. There was a very important video that was prepared, and that got national news coverage. Five centers were set up to deal with injuries. So in Denmark, the Cochrane Collaboration had a Nordic center, and it was part of an international collaboration of scientists to really look at what was evidence-based, not to just take, you know, what corporations say is sort of, you know, good medicine, but to really do more deep, thorough research on what's already out there. And they got money from a whole variety of sources. So the Nordic Collaboration, in the center of this controversy around the HPV vaccine, was critical of the HPV vaccine. And one of the things they did is they asked for all of the clinical trial evidence, not just what was submitted to the FDA or the European Medicines Agency, but they tried to gather all of the clinical trial data. So the things that the corporations didn't submit to the regulators, and there were some clinical trial that had been done by other institutions. What they learned was that about half of the data had been submitted to the federal regulators. So when they looked at that data, they were quite critical. They were critical of what we've just discussed, that there was no real placebo.
Right.
They were critical of sort of the switch in age groups, that it had been in this older age cohort, but then the recommendation was for it to be for a younger group. They had a number of critiques of it. And after the Nordic collaboration had given a first round of critiques of the HPV vaccine, the UK-based Cochrane Collaboration came out with a starkly different review, and it basically gave a clean bill of health to the HPV vaccine. Well, and I should say, actually, then the Nordic even went further. They actually lodged a complaint against the European Medicines Agency for a report that it had issued about the HPV. Then it complained against, then it took another complaint after the EMA didn't satisfy them. They took a complaint to the European Ombudsman. So they really raised the profile of their deep concerns that both the EMA and Merck had not met their burden. But then the UK branch of Cochrane Collaboration came out with a separate report, very favorable. Turns out that the Bill and Melinda Gates had given them $1 million. Bill and Melinda Gates has been quite involved in marketing the HPV vaccine in a variety of countries, including India. And then this is now really an open controversy, right? This is a civil war within the Cochrane Collaboration. And at its most recent annual international forum, Peter Gutsche, the head of the Nordic Collaboration, he was ousted.
right.
By the board.
And he's one of the founders. For people
and
who
he's
don't...
one of the founders, and he's now, you know, put out videos. I mean, he's... we haven't heard the last of Peter Gutchen.
He's not easy to suppress.
No,
he's a tough guy.
He's a very challenging guy. We quote from him quite a lot. He wrote an excellent book called Deadly Medicine about, you know, sort of serious problems in the medical industrial complex, comparing, you know, some of the corporations to organized crime. So he's a serious critic. He's a very
right.
serious physician and scientist. And as I say, we have definitely not heard the last.
Yeah, I first heard about him because of his work on mammography, which started in the late 1990s. But he was critical because some of the people in Cochrane collaboration studying mammography were taking money from industry. And the whole point of the Cochrane collaboration was to be
exactly.
a science that was free of the effects of money. And it was supposed to be purely what they call evidence-based medicine. And that's what this big fight is about. And like you say, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has been giving money. People would say, well, that's a charity. So if a charity gives money to Cochrane collaboration, that's a good thing. But does the Gates Foundation have investments in drug companies?
It does. It does, and it also is financing, you know, the vaccines that are bought by the Global Alliance for Vaccination and Immunization, a sort of an international charitable organization. We wrote a chapter about what happened in India, and the clinical trials for the HPV vaccines, both of Merck and Glaxo, were so bad, and many girls died, that they banned the vaccines from the country for several years, and they've completely revamped their procedures for clinical trials, now requiring videotaped consent to participate in clinical
Hello.
Trials. And in that case, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation financed the HPV vaccines that were distributed by an international public health organization.
I think most people don't realize that the Gates are not giving their money away. What they're doing is they're investing their money and they're giving away the interest. And that means that they have to invest in profitable things in order to generate interest to give away money. And that means that they have a conflict of interest.
Well, they certainly have deep interests in the vaccine industry. I don't think there's any question about that.
Anyway, we could talk about this a lot longer. I would just like to say that we've only touched the surface of your book. I found it very clear. There's a lot of technical information in there. It's a little bit like a detective story because there's so many, you know, bad things that were done that are shocking, what was done with the placebo and things like that. But if you're interested in learning more about it, I can highly recommend it. So it's called The HPV Vaccine on Trial, Seeking Justice for a Generation Betrayed. And would you like to make a final comment? Is there something big that we didn't get to?
Thank you, David. I really appreciate it. I would just say that I think, you know, we as humans really, it's easier to relate to human stories than it is to a whole bunch of data. So we include the data, but we have the stories of the kids and their families. And kids have been harmed by this, and they don't deserve to be harmed. So people need to know that there's a real risk of harm here, and then make their decisions accordingly.
Yes, I love the science and the analysis, but my heart breaks when I read those stories, when you're really destroying not just the child, but the whole family.
Right.
Of course, people continue to try to look after as best they can, but, you know, they must be filled with regret
right.
their entire rest of their lives. Thank you for joining me today, Mary.
Thank you
I really
so much for
appreciate
having
it.
Me.
Okay, goodbye.
Take care. Bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 199 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. You can like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye. On Instagram at infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.